Hello, everyone. Mike Staley here, and welcome to Silent Night, the Cassandra Cain podcast. I tell you, there's a lot going on with Cassandra right now. Of course, we've got her involved in the whole deceased storyline, which admittedly, I'm slightly hesitant to read because I'm afraid that she's going to die in it because it's not like the official DC universe. And I, even if it's not official, I don't want to see her die. So I've been kind of hesitant to read it, but I'm going to have to when I eventually get to that at some point in the podcast here. And of course, also, we got Cassandra starting to gain something of a relationship with Shiva. I'm interested in seeing where they're going to go with this, if she's going to, at some point, join up with Shiva, not necessarily become a bad guy, but just go with her rather than being with the Bat family, or if they're going to have her stay with the Bats. I've heard some people saying that she's kind of stagnating with Batman, and unfortunately that's kind of true, mainly because the writers just don't seem willing to do anything with her. She wants to be a real part of the Bat family. She wants to be able to wear that symbol, yet the writers just do not seem to want to give her that. So, I'm interested in seeing where they're going to be going with that. At the same time, I'm kind of hoping maybe this will give them an excuse to change her name, because I am one of a number of people who do not like the name Orphan. And one of the big reasons for that is it's not Google-friendly. You're trying to look up things on Cassandra Cain and you try to search based on Orphan, you are not going to get Cassandra Cain. She needs a name that is more her, that's Google friendly, and if you look up this name, you're going to get Cassandra. I'm kind of hoping they're going to, you know, go that direction soon. I guess we'll find out. But gonna go ahead and take a quick little podcast promo break here, and then we will be back with the first of our two stories for today.
I hope he's home. Why does it sound like I'm using a phone in the UK?
I told you never to call me again.
Yeah, I know. And modern science has yet to create a device to measure how much I don't care. Look, I'm getting the trailer for this year's JL May together, and I assumed I had to make you a part of it since you're always in everybody's trailer or something.
Well, look at you, leading this year's JL May. Somebody's wearing his big boy pants. So, what's the theme?
I sent you an email like a month ago.
Like I even pay attention to anything you send me.
Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
Infinite Crisis?
No, Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
I'm not following.
Shocking. The theme this year, I'm talking to a child. The theme this year is Countdown to Infinite Crisis. I thought it was a fascinating time period in DC's history, so a bunch of us are getting together to talk about the various specials and miniseries and crossovers that led up to Infinite Crisis. It's the event before the event. The whole thing is going to kick off on April 30th, 2020, with a special episode of Views from the Long Box covering the Countdown to Infinite Crisis 80-page giant, and from there, a whole bunch of shows that I will be adding in post-production will discuss these previously mentioned miniseries and crossover issues.
And people actually agreed to this?
Shockingly, yes!
Well, it's probably a good thing that you're going to cover Countdown to Infinite Crisis instead of the Countdown series, because that was a train wreck.
Yeah, you know, actually, that was my thinking, too. Now, are you going to help me with this trailer or not?
Fine. I will help you with your little trailer.
Good. Don't worry, by the way. There won't be any dates for you to get wrong.
I hate you so much.
JL May 2020. Countdown to Infinite Crisis. The event before the event. This crossover kicks off on April 30th, 2020, on Views from the Long Box, and continues into Aquaman and Firestorm, the Fire and Water podcast, Robin, Everyone Loves the Drake, Pop Culture Affidavit, it all comes back to Superman, the Fanholes Podcast, Justice's First Dawn, the Birds of Prey Podcast, Married with Comics, the Coffee and Comics Podcast, the Long Box Crusade, Task Force X, Relatively Geeky Presents, Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace, and the Dr. DC Podcast.
And we're back. We're starting off with Batman Outlaws number 2, cover dated 2000, released on August 2nd, 2000. Written by Doug Mensch, penciled by Paul Galassi, inked by Charles Yoakum, colored by Gloria Vasquez, and lettered by Willie Schubert. Dead Gargoyles. The cover shows Batman holding a prone Commissioner Gordon in front of a bullet hole filled bat symbol. Nightwing, Robin, Huntress, and Batgirl surround them. The story opens with Gordon and Harvey Bullock being summoned to the leader of the Bloodhawks anti-vigilante force, Colonel Redman. Bullock gives us exposition about Redman using his federal pull to take control over Gotham. Neither the sergeant or the commissioner like it, but find their hands tied. Redman chastises Gordon for being late, assuring him that he'd be fired under the colonel's command. After degrading the aerodrome they've been given, Redman assures Gordon that the info given to the commissioner was done as a courtesy alone. In return, he wants all of the info Gordon has on every vigilante in Gotham. That night, the Bat family sneak through the streets, avoiding the helicopters searching for them. They meet up with Gordon to discuss the events happening, whether vigilantes should be stopped, Redman's former but possible continued involvement with the FIA, and the agent's desire not to arrest, but kill the Bats. The Dark Knight believes Redman's attacks on them is a cover-up for his own plans, though he can't prove it yet. Specifically, he thinks Redman may have been behind the assassination of Senator John Kirk. Gordon gives Batman the dossier Redman gave him, when suddenly the helicopters spot them and begin firing. Gordon hides out as the Bat family scatters. In desperation to ensure the vigilantes are taken out, the choppers turn to firing missiles on the roof and sending jet-packed soldiers out. Batman and Nightwing take out the soldiers. The Dark Knight puts on one of the jetpacks and leads the helicopters away while Nightwing and Huntress head for the basement. Robin nearly gets sniped, but Batgirl makes the save. The two of them get Gordon out. Back at the Batcave, Bruce and, apparently, Oracle note that the dossier is full of fake information except for several pictures of different mercenaries associated with the Bloodhawks. They also go over the death of Kirk, believed to be by Henry James Lucas, though everything they see seems to suggest the Bloodhawks were behind it. But without more proof, they can't act. Meanwhile, Redman is getting an update on the failure of the rooftop battle. He begrudges that none of the vigilantes are dead, all of this overheard by a spying Catwoman. We then move to Bullock and Renee Montoya, discussing whether someone like Batman should be allowed to do what he does. Bullock considers Batman a cop, though unofficially, and even suggests he'd buy him a donut if he could. Later, both Batman and Catwoman individually arrive at the Bloodhawks' base. Selina confronts Batman and gives him the proof he needs, which she had acquired earlier. The proof is a video of Redman admitting he wants them dead, and mention of Project Afterlife. The video, illegally obtained, is not admissible in court, so they have to keep working. So Oracle can research Project Afterlife, Nightwing takes the evidence to deliver it personally to her. On his way back, the former Boy Wonder is attacked by the Hawks, a civilian getting killed in the crossfire. He runs for it, drawing them away from other innocents. The Hawks follow him into a building, but he manages to slow them down, dropping a collection of barrels on them. He warns them of the consequences of their killing ways before escaping. Slate, Redmond's second-in-command, warns him of what happened and their need to turn it to their advantage. By the time Nightwing gets to the others, the blame going through the media is directed at Grayson himself. Huntress says they need to attack themselves, but Batman insists that they need more evidence. This leads to an argument, but Batman manages to calm things down by explaining that they can't take the bait of being what Redman accused them of, and the Bloodhawks have to make the mistake first. Oracle contacts them with information about Project Afterlife. Since the Cold War, the FIA has created terrorists to continue their position as essential protection for America. While Oracle continues looking for more, Batman plans a trip to Central America to talk to a dictator the FIA had helped get into power. To be continued. Biggest thing about this book was the art, which was very hit or miss. The battles looked really good, and I loved the facial expressions on the characters. You could really see a lot of detail and a lot of emotion in the faces. But there were certain aspects of the art which I don't think were entirely the fault of Glacy. Some of this probably had to do with the inking, the coloring. But for example, during the big rooftop fight, there are several shots coming from the helicopters, and the beams of the bullets zipping across the sky, there's one shot where it looks like Robin and Batgirl are both being hit by those beams, when it's supposed to be insinuating that the beams are passing by them, but just the way it was set up here makes it almost look like they're getting hit. The other big thing is Barbara Gordon. To be honest, I didn't realize that this was Barbara Gordon in the comic until they said so, because her hair is shorter than normal, and it is also kind of a black and purple color rather than the bright red that her hair usually is. It was kind of jarring, and like I said, I couldn't even tell that it was Oracle until they said it. Another interesting thing about this story is Harvey Bullock liking Batman. Now, characters evolve, you know, I've seen this evolution, but it's still, I will never not find it weird to see Harvey Bullock praising Batman, because I'm just so used to growing up with him hating Batman. So it's just, that's something that's always weird to me. The Batman and Huntress argument was not as bad as I expected. I mean, the two of them are always going at it, because that's pretty much the story. She wants to be a vigilante, but she is a little more violent and harsh than Batman. Batman keeps claiming that he wants to give her a chance, but only if she does things his way. It's very much his way or the highway. So these two are always at each other's throats. I'm kind of surprised that the fight was calmed down as easily as it was in this particular case. I wish we'd gotten more Cass here. She only really has involvement in the fight scene, and I get, you know, with the scope of this whole story, you can only do so much with her because you got all these other characters you're trying to focus on as well. But as Cass fan, you know, I always wish I could see more of her in the stories. Something else I kind of wish we could have seen is how Catwoman got that information. We saw her spying on them, but we don't see how she got the dossier, but the information about Project Afterlife. I can accept that we didn't see it because it's Catwoman, so you can accept that she just is that good, but it would have been nice to see. Other big problem is Nightwing. When he's fighting against the Bloodhawks, he gets that point when he's leaving and he tells them, you know, you killed an innocent. The cops are not going to accept that. You're going down now. It's like, well, congratulations, dude. You've officially told them what you're going to do and given them time to plan it out. Nightwing is not this stupid. This is not a good way to write this. there are other ways they could have done this. They could have very simply had them realize, crap, we killed someone in the middle of this. This could end up looking bad on us. We better work around it. You didn't need to have Nightwing say something, because that makes Nightwing look like a complete idiot, which he is not. Other than these things, I did enjoy the story. There was a lot of action, that rooftop fight scene. I could envision that, either live action or animated, as a full scene, and I would actually love to see it. It was really cool looking. And I'm intrigued to find out what they're going to do. Although I hope they're not going to spend the entirety of next issue, which I believe is the final issue of this particular story arc, doing continued, oh, we got this evidence, but it's not enough proof. We have to wait. Oh, we got this evidence, but it's not enough proof. We have to wait. They were doing that a little too much at this point. In general, enjoyed the story, but it did have some problems that hopefully they will be fixing in the next one. All right, so that's all we've got for the first story. We're going to take another little podcast promo break, and then we'll be back with our second story.
Hey, I'm Jen.
And I'm Sean. We're here to tell you about our podcast, Worst Collection Ever.
And this is the show where we tell you about the worst comic book collection in existence, and it just happens to belong to us.
We have some of the worst comics from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They're bad. They're not worth anything.
No good.
Why do we own them? I own number of issues of Terror Inc. and Guy Gardner.
Basically, we go around to local comic book stores and we buy everything we can out of dollar boxes.
We tell you about the weird stuff in them. We tell you about stuff that's related to them. We go into tangents and we're very uninformed, so.
Oh my God, totally. But totally check out our podcast, because you'll hear us just talk and joke about Marvel books and DC books from God only knows when.
That's right. It's our show, Worst Collection Ever, every Tuesday on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your podcasts. Download, rate, subscribe, tell a friend.
It'll be good and terrible, but good.
And we're back. Next, we've got Batman and Robin Eternal, number 5. Cover dated January 2016, released November 4th, 2015. Plotted by James Tynion IV and Scott Snyder. Scripted by Steve Orlando. Penciled by Scott Eaton. Art by Ronan Cliquet and Steve Pugh. Inked by Wayne Foucher. Colored by Gabriel A. El-Taib. And lettered by David Sharp. Arms of the Thunderer. The cover shows Red Robin attacking Grayson with lasers firing around them. We open in Gotham City several years ago. Batman and Robin are listening in on a conversation between Scarecrow and Orphan. Orphan is chastising Scarecrow for drawing too much attention to himself, thus delaying their plans. The Master of Fear starts to talk back, but Cassandra appears behind him, a blade to his neck. Orphan realizes the dynamic duo is coming, and the three of them disappear just as Batman and Robin fly in. We move on to the Drake House in the present, where Dick Grayson, under the guise of Lyle Dixon, is talking to the Drakes about Tim. Surprisingly, they tell him Tim had died in a car accident years ago. Before he can go further into it, Poppy shows up. Elsewhere, Cassandra and Harper enter the same church Orphan and Scarecrow had met at years before, though now it's pretty dilapidated. Harper tries to get some information from the ever-silent Cass, but suddenly Orphan appears and throws Cass aside.
Why follow her, Ro? To make a connection? She's incapable of that. We made her that way. She doesn't know how.
Back at the Drakes, Grayson and Poppy battle it out while Janet Drake, starting to realize that they've been hypnotized, calls out a code word. The living room begins to transform, causing both Grayson and Poppy to stop. At the church, Harper attempts to defend herself, but Orphan's skill and her injuries prevent her from even being a challenge for him. At that point, Cassandra lunges back into the battle, going hard after Orphan.
You really think what you've done can be redeemed? People get redemption. You're not a person. You're only alive in moments of death. You're a monster. That is how I defined your existence.
He offers her a hand, which C proceeds to slice off with Orphan's own sword. Feeling his point has been proven, and knowing he's at a disadvantage, Orphan sets off an explosion to cover his escape, but Harper manages to plant a tracker on him. Harper gives a teary-eyed Cassandra her vote of confidence. Back at the other fight, Grayson and Poppy have gone to blows again, dodging laser blasts from wall-mounted turrets. Poppy gets shot. Grayson manages to get her and get out, only to be confronted by Red Robin. Clearly ticked off, he checks on his parents. Afterwards, he berates Dick for bringing his family into it and choosing for himself who should and shouldn't be trusted. Dick says that he had to know and that Bruce would have done the same. Tim nails him with a right hand, saying he never expected Dick to do the same as Bruce. To be continued. Now, the first thing I gotta ask here is, how old is Cassandra supposed to be here? She's in that scene in the past, in which Dick Grayson is a teenager, and yet now she's here in the present, looking the exact same. Is the idea supposed to be that it was a different person wearing the same costume? Or is there some type of like genetic thing going on that prevented Cassandra from aging? This is really confusing, and I'm hoping they're going to explain this in future issues, because that is really weird that Cassandra is in both of those times. Speaking of that shot in the past, when Batman and Robin are flying into the church, the face on Robin, I'm not entirely sure how to describe it. His mouth is like pinching over to the sides up very widely, and he looks kind of like an old man. It's weird. I'm not entirely sure what they were going for there. I do have to wonder if Batman helped Tim set up all those defenses in his parents' house, because I know that Tim easily could have come up with the ideas for them, and he could have built them, but that stuff's still going to require money that Tim Drake does not have. So I'm wondering if Batman helped him set that up as a safeguard, since Tim is known for being like the only Robin to have normal parents that are still alive, if we ignore Identity Crisis, but then that's pre-New 52 anyway. I'm loving the buildup for Cassandra, especially here having Orphan talk about how she's not a real person, she's a monster, she's just a killer, and the emotion that we see from her as Harper just hugs her and she's in tears. This is good. I really am enjoying this buildup for Cassandra's character and her past, and I'm really looking forward to seeing where they go with this. The Bat family is falling apart. We've already got Bruce out of the picture, and now Tim is on bad terms with Dick. Jason is on bad terms with everybody. I don't think there's anybody he really likes. Cassandra and Harper have run off on their own, and I don't know what's going on with Stephanie. I don't know that I'd say this is as good as some of the previous issues of this storyline I have read. I definitely liked the Cassandra stuff. I think we're building her character really well. This wasn't bad, just I don't think it was as exciting, and it didn't draw me in as some of the previous issues, but I'm definitely still invested, really looking forward to seeing what happens next. Well, that's all I've got on this set of stories here. So, until next time.
You've been listening to Silent Night, the Cassandra Cain podcast. Feedback for the show can be left at CassandraCainCast@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at StaleDog with two G's, because I was a teen in the 90s. If you want to help us out, leave a review on iTunes because it gets more eyes on the show. Find more geeky fun at my YouTube channel, Mike's Geek World. All characters and music used in the show are copyrighted to their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Thank you for listening, and come back next time for another episode of Silent Night, the Cassandra Cain Podcast.